Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Kevin Coogan, the author of the consummately important recent volume Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. The book was published in softcover by autonomedia.org, copyright 1999, and at the end of this half hour, we're going to give you the information about where to get it. By the way, I get no monies from this presentation. Kevin, welcome back once again to our airways.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that you're suffering from a touch of the flu, so I'm going to ask the audience to bear in mind your wounded status and circumstances here. Anyway, the subject of the book, Francis Parker Yockey. Tell us who he was.
Francis Parker Yockey was a very mysterious figure. He was an American far-rightist who is probably best known for writing a book called Imperium, which was first published in London in 1948. Imperium outlined a strategy for a new post-war fascist international, and the strategy was to basically unite all of Europe against what Yockey called the two sort of enemies of Europe, namely America and Russia. He then led a very mysterious underground life, which I try to explain in the book, which culminated in his being arrested by the FBI in San Francisco in June of 1960. The FBI had been looking for Yockey because they heard rumors that he somehow had a relationship with the Soviet Union. But they could never really find out what the truth was, because a few weeks after Yockey's arrest, he took a cyanide capsule and committed suicide. So right at the point where the FBI was beginning to unravel the mystery, their main piece of evidence, namely Yockey, died. And essentially what my book tries to do is my book tries to, A, explore the ideas behind Imperium, the way Yockey's ideas fit into the emerging post-war fascist movement in Europe and in the United States, and then recreate the actual history of the mystery man that the FBI really never had a chance to do. So that's sort of a rough outline of the book.
Before we get into the Imperium concept more deeply, which is something I'd like to do, let's get into, or if I'm going to ask you to do the impossible, which is to synoptically account for us, or at least identify a post-war fascist international, because you do talk about Yockey's involvement with this post-war fascist underground that is certainly nothing if not international.
Well, I think the best way to think about it is to think about Europe in 1945. Essentially, the whole Nazi experiment had failed, and Germany, of course, was in ruins. At the same time, Italy was in ruins as well, with Mussolini executed. In England, Sir Oswald Mosley was in jail. In France, a lot of the people who collaborated during the Vichy times were either arrested or actually being executed. So there was this tremendous problem of how do you move forward with an ideology that had basically been so discredited with the defeat of Hitler. And the defeat of Hitler was one of the keys, because the people who wanted to continue said, look, one of the major problems we had is that fascism became so dominated by Germany and by German racialism that it essentially put Germany itself kind of in the driver's seat. And we should replace this concept not with this idea of German power leading Europe, but with more of a new concept of what Europe is, which is the idea that Europe should be itself a kind of continental mini superpower to oppose both America and Russia, and that we should get away from this idea of the sort of German racial superiority over all other people in Europe. So this had been an idea that had been percolating even during the war inside circles, for example, in Germany in the Waffen-SS. People who were looking towards other fascist movements to kind of create a unified Europe, but it never achieved any real influence during the war, basically because the idea of German racial superiority was so dominant. But after the war, in the wake of Germany's defeat, this idea began to reemerge, and Yockey was one of the first people to promote this idea in a theoretical form, namely in his book Imperium.
Before we get into some of his antecedents and developing the concept of Imperium further, which I'd like you to do for us, Kevin, something that might appear to be something of a digression, but something that I think is important in and of itself, And also, at the risk of seeming like a flatterer, I think is characteristic of the exhaustive scholarship that is evident in your book and for which you deserve a lot of credit. Tell us about Karl Hanke, footnoted on page 372. Who was he and where did he go?
Well, this is one of these sort of bizarre stories that occurred at the end of the war. Karl Hanke was a former Gauleiter, or a district leader in Germany, who had been very much involved with the Nazi Party since, as a kind of a power broker since the 1930s. Right at the end of the war, he was appointed by Hitler the new head of the SS. Now, most people think that Himmler was head of the SS until his capture and his own suicide. Himmler, I should note, also took, I believe, a cyanide capsule himself. But at the end of the war, because Himmler was making certain peace overtures to the Allies, and this kind of leaked back to the Führer bunker, Hitler appointed this guy Hanke to head up the SS. Now, at the very end, Hanke simply disappeared. The mystery is that Hanke, they had a helicopter that picked him up, he and a few of his cohorts, and flew off. And nobody to this day knows what happened to that helicopter. It was alleged at one point that maybe he had been shot down, but there was no discovery of any body. So this is one of these bizarre mysteries that sort of percolate through the post-war period, and which give rise to many legends. For example, the whole mystery or imbroglio around, did Martin Bormann die in Berlin in 1945, or did he survive? The Hanke story is kind of a story like that, except this, you know, this thing really happened. I stumbled upon the reference actually in a fairly scholarly book by a man named Walter LeCur, and co-written with a man named Richard Breitman, called Breaking the Silence, which is essentially a book about the way the news about the Holocaust came to the West. But in that book, they actually discuss Hanke and his history. I myself was completely flabbergasted when I read it, and I couldn't resist. I could not put that in the book, you know, without some kind of commentary on it, because it really is bizarre.
Not to take too much time on this, it was actually an early helicopter that he escaped in that.
Yeah.
So, and the prototypes and the early functional models did exist at that time. Now, let's move on, Kevin. Yaki wrote his opus called Imperium. From what I understand, I, of course, have not read it, but it's an exhaustive book now sold by the Liberty Lobby, correct?
Yep.
If you could tell us a little bit about Imperium is Latin for empire, right?
Yes. The idea of Imperium was this vision of a post-war unified Europe, but a Europe unified under the idea of a new form of fascism, which was not centered around German domination. And behind Imperium was the notion that Europe had been occupied, using Yaki's language, by the Russians on the one hand and the Americans / the Jews on the other. And to his way of thinking, the Americans were actually in many ways worse than the Russians. And so the idea of Imperium was basically, as he put it, to expel the barbarian, by which he meant the Russians, and the, quote, cultural distorters, by which he meant the Americans. And that this would unite the various disparate fascist elements into this new unified force against these two occupiers.
Does Yaki actually analyze how this was going to be done from a practical standpoint, or does he merely philosophize?
The I would say it's really from the standpoint of trying to create a new vision. I mean, he doesn't present a blueprint of how this is done. And in fact, the book is written in a way to sort of inspire the defeated cadre to present a new vision, which will in future generations come to fruition. So he concludes his book by saying it's, you know, whether this vision will occur in, you know, 1950 or 100 years from now, you know, no one can say. All we can say is that destiny is, you know, kind of working in this direction, and the vision will eventually, you know, come true. This is in part because Yaki very much derived many of his ideas from Oswald Spengler, and one of Spengler's theories was that there would be in the West a sort of a final rise of what Spengler called Caesarism, And under this Caesarism, Europe would be united once again. And in Spengler's thinking, for example, Napoleon was a sort of a forerunner of this vision. And then what Yaki did is, reading off of Spengler, he decided not just Napoleon, but Hitler both represented this drive to unite Europe into what they called kind of Europe a nation, a new superpower against the against America and Russia.
One of the things I want to interject is that for listeners who have an overly simplistic or ideologized view of fascism and its related far-right philosophies, I think that Dreamer of the Day will do much to highlight many of the philosophical and practical differences between some of these schools, and it does so at great length. Yaki made at least a cursory political attempt at realizing, well, perhaps I would say it as realizing Imperium. Tell us about the European Liberation Front, if you would.
Well, the European Liberation Front was something created by Yaki in 1948. What he had hoped to do at one point was to win over Sir Oswald Mosley, who had been the primary figure in British fascism all throughout the 1930s. And after the war, both Mosley and Yaki promoted, like, once again, this idea of Europe acting collectively as opposed to individual national fascist movements. But basically, Yaki and Mosley had a falling out. I should say parenthetically that Yaki knew Mosley, and Yaki worked at one point in London in 1947-48 with the Union Movement, which was Mosley's operation. But essentially, the big fight between them was over the question of, should the far right sympathize with America against Russia? And to sort of make a long story short, Mosley's argument was that no matter how bad an American occupation of Europe was, the idea that the Russians would totally conquer Western Europe was far worse. And so he essentially put forward the concept that although America was the enemy, it was not as evil an enemy as Russia. And this was a concept actually that Yaki opposed. So because he and Mosley sort of had a falling out, Yaki and some of the people from the Union Movement that split out with Yaki in 1948 created the European Liberation Front essentially to promote the ideas of Imperium. And Yaki sort of went on propaganda tours throughout Europe advocating this idea, in Belgium, Germany, Italy, etc., kind of against Mosley.
One of the things that you talk about, Kevin, are splits or at least divisions, factions within the SS itself, which had very different views of the political present and future, at least back in the 1940s. You talk about a Waffen-SS faction, which in many ways influenced Yaki and his concept of Imperium. I wonder if you'd tell us about some of these people, for example, Alfred Franke Gritsch. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. Alfred Sieks, Werner Best, and people like Alfred Binet and others.
Well, probably the most important person in this whole milieu is a guy named Werner Best, who had been a very important legal figure inside the German SS, particularly inside the SD, which was the sort of intelligence wing of the SS. He later went on to become the German overlord of occupied France, and then from 1943 to 45 was the German controller of Denmark. He had looked to certain people, for example, a legal philosopher named Carl Schmitt, who had earlier promoted this idea of what he called the theory of Großraumordnung. Now, I know your listeners, your heads are probably spinning at all this, but to try and simplify it, Schmitt's idea was that Germany would, as the dominant power in Europe, would essentially have a relationship to other European nations in much the same way that America was the dominant power in North America and would have a relationship to Latin America through the Monroe Doctrine. In other words, the concept was, we will be the most important power, but we will not, you know, militarily take over and occupy all of Latin America. So the idea was that Germany would use its sort of cultural, economic, and political influence to be the most important sort of spoke in the wheel of a new Europe, but that the idea that the Germans somehow were sort of racially superior, and that the, you know, the French, or the Greeks, or the, Yugoslavians, or people like that, would somehow serve as sort of slaves to the Reich, was a concept that, was essentially foreign to Schmidt. Now, this caused a lot of difficulty inside the SS, because the SS was dominated by Heinrich Himmler, and Himmler really did believe in blood theory. He was, a Volk theorist. And so he felt very strongly that the Germans were the superior race, and that all other races should sort of obey them. So the idea of this Waffen-SS concept, this, sometimes call it like a kind of a kindler, gentler SS, handling the occupation of Europe, essentially never came to fruition during the war. But as it became more and more clear that Germany was losing the war, and Germany needed the support of, volunteers, for example, from, France and Belgium and, Holland, etc., to go and fight in the East against the Russians, some of this idea of a kind of a pan-European fascism began to be promoted by ideologues like Best and another guy who was a very important propaganda man in the SS, a guy named Franz Alfred Six. So this idea sort of began in embryo during the war, and then after the war took on more of an ideological character. And I believe, actually, that when Yaki wrote Imperium, Yaki was, in fact, reflecting this sort of what I call this Waffen-SS tendency. In other words, his ideas simply weren't unique to him. He was essentially an early post-war spokesman for certain concepts that had been brewing during the war itself.
You also make clear, Kevin, as we touched on in our first interview, that Yaki himself was involved with these types of elements before, during, and after World War II. So he certainly, he not only wasn't a stranger to them, he was an intimate of them.
Right, right. And my belief is that in writing Imperium, and remember that he wrote Imperium in 1948, he had actually been in Europe since 1945 and had traveled and had met with these some of these people. I think that he was really promoting arguments that were by no means unique to him.
One of the points that I wanted to underscore, Kevin, about Yaki's brand of fascism, it's something we've already touched on, but many people who have perhaps a simplistic or over-ideologized view of fascism see fascism as a very simple right and left thing. Certainly, that's an important component. Yet I've also heard people talk about fascism as undoubtedly being allied with America. Fascism is no stranger to this country among its industrialists and plenty who found cause to identify with the SS and others. Yet one of the things that I think needs to be stressed is the virulent anti-Americanism of Yaki's outlook and of those around him. And he actually saw America as the greater threat to world freedom. To world fascism.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's striking how much he hated the United States. In fact, the last essay that he wrote before he was captured by the FBI is an essay that was published under the title The World in Flames. And in that essay, he makes it very clear that he hoped that America would basically be destroyed in some kind of nuclear conflict. I mean, he absolutely loathed the United States. And he did it partly because of anti-Semitism, where he believed that the United States had been sort of taken over by the Jews, et cetera, fill in the blanks. But also, and this is kind of what makes Imperium somewhat more interesting than just a standard sort of anti-Semitic rant, he also felt that America itself had been also corrupted just by the nature of the country itself, by the fact that it was based on Enlightenment principles and rationalism, and was a very new form of society, and he just despised it.
I think a lot of his virulent anti-Americanism is reflected in some elements of contemporary domestic fascism. One hears from Liberty Lobby elements to Aryan, some of the like National Alliance,
well,
I should
yes,
say.
Yes, I this is very true, because if you look at the sort of changes in the American far right from the 1960s till today, it's become much more anti-government and much more critical of, federal authorities. In the 1960s, the groups like the Klan still essentially believed in white supremacy, and they believed that you could sort of rally the white majority to resist integration and liberalism, etc. But by the late 70s, the idea of actually racial separatism, and essentially the radical right abandoned this idea of controlling the center, and they moved off into these kind of wild schemes to set up sort of free Aryan nations in the Pacific Northwest, etc. In other words, they gave up on the country, and at that point, the people, like, for example, organizations like the FBI, who had been seen by many rightists as a bulwark against, the commies, etc.,
mm-hmm.
suddenly the FBI became the great enemy. And so within the American radical right, there this strain of, real hatred of America and identification with, Nazism and Nazi symbols dramatically increased. And I think that you're getting within the extreme right this sense that Yaki had of, America itself should be basically just destroyed. And at best, you can start over sort of a new white nation, somewhere up in the, up in Iowa, or not Iowa, Idaho, or someplace like that. I mean, they've just given up on controlling the United States.
And again, for those who think that fascism necessarily, and this is not a fine point, but it means waving the flag, this should give them some other thoughts in that regard.
Absolutely.
Kevin, the title of your book, the subject of your book, rather, Francis Parker Yaki, is not very well known among most people, although very influential. Yet he wielded a significant influence on someone who is perhaps the best known figure of the American far right, Joe McCarthy.
Yes, well, that's kind of a mysterious story, which I actually came across by going through the FBI files. I would say that what happened is that there was a kind of a confluence of interests in the early 1950s. To tell the story in brief, Yaki at one point became a ghostwriter for Senator McCarthy. And this occurred in 1952 when Yaki was living sub rosa in Washington, D.C. He actually wrote a couple of speeches for McCarthy, which the FBI later discovered. Now, the reason why this sort of emerged is that in the early 50s, McCarthy was one of the people who was arguing that the United States prosecution of the Nuremberg war crimes trials prosecutions, that this was a terrible thing. And that the German troops, the members of even of SS divisions that had been involved in the Malmedy massacre, they were actually good guys who had been wronged by kind of evil Jewish lawyers working for the war crimes tribunal, et cetera, et cetera. And so he began a very important campaign to attack the legitimacy of the entire war crimes process. Now, at that time, there were also elements inside the American military, inside the Pentagon, who also wanted to roll back the whole war crimes tribunal apparatus, not for any ideological reasons, but because they were trying to incorporate as quickly as possible the old German military into a United States-aligned NATO. And they saw the war crimes trials as basically alienating a lot of important German leaders who would not cooperate with the United States as long as those trials were going on. So they had their own reasons for doing this. Yaki himself, because Yaki, from a very early period, in fact, from 1946, when Yaki was working, I should just backtrack and say, Yaki was, in 1946, Yaki came to Germany, believe it or not, as a lawyer for the War Crimes Tribunal. He had somehow maneuvered himself into this position. And then when he got into the tribunal, Yaki was based in Wiesbaden. He began collecting information, which he gave over to lawyers for a lot of these accused war criminals. So Yaki, from a very early period, was out to sort of sabotage the war crimes process. So for his own reasons, Yaki found himself very much in rapport with what McCarthy was doing and worked with McCarthy.
You write on page 242, Kevin, quoting briefly, and bearing in mind Diaki's influence on McCarthy and the Malmedy trials. By the way, for veteran listeners, that's also discussed in RFA program number 2. Not Diaki influence, but McCarthy's involvement in the Malmedy case. Despite the Baldwin subcommittee's report defending the Army, the negative publicity generated by the Malmedy case ruined the war crimes trials process. According to historian Tom Bauer, the Malmedy controversy was, quote, the biggest calamity to befall the attempt to punish the individual murderers, unquote. So much so that serious attempts at denazification, again quoting, collapsed in its wake, unquote. A considerable influence indeed. Kevin, did you want to comment on that?
Well, I just want to say, actually, Bauer also makes the point that within the Pentagon itself, there were many people who were wanting to shut down the whole process. In other words, the McCarthy was not simply acting alone.
Sure.
He had his supporters inside the military who were promoting the same general argument. Again, as I stress, really for pragmatic reasons, not so much for any ideological reasons.
And that concludes an interview with Kevin Coogan, done on March 19th of the year 2000. And I'm happy to announce that very soon, Kevin's unpublished or hitherto unpublished manuscript, American Gladio, which was the focal point and the major component of For the Record program number 188, is going to be published. Kevin has an English publisher, The Lobster Magazine, who in all likelihood, who are going to be publishing Kevin's manuscript. He is going to be fine-tuning it. I will let you know when that manuscript is available, and give you all of the appropriate information, because, again, it's an extremely important document, and I'm very pleased to hear that Kevin is getting that published. I'm going to give you the information, etc., for Kevin's consummately important book, Dreamer of the Day. That book, once again, Dreamer of the Day, by Kevin Coogan, subtitled Francis Parker Yaki and the Post-War Fascist International, is published in softcover by Autono Media, capital AUTONOMEDIA, one word. You can visit their website at autonomedia.org, www.autonomedia.org, or you can write to them at Post Office Box 568, Williamsburg Station, Williamsburgh, one word station, Brooklyn, New York, 11211-0568, USA. Phone and fax, 718-963-2603. Once again, 718-963-2603. I would note that the book was edited by Dave Mandel, last name M-A-N-D-L, who I understand is a disc jockey or air personality on WFMU-FM. That is one of the stations that carries the For the Record segments and does so in the New York area. So there's a bit of the homeboy touch in terms of the editing of Dreamer of the Day. That concludes this program. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.